Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
Hello, I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the June 3rd edition of SciPod, fly it again, Sam. In an effort to get to the bottom of a mysterious anomaly that could change the laws of physics, NASA scientists prepare to rerun an historic mission 1 second at a time.
Cold case. Does hot water really freeze faster? At long last, an unsolved physics mystery may have a solution.
Digital DJ. We try out some software that chooses the music you want to hear, even when you've never heard it before.
And in science news, out of step. Why the rhythm method may be the world's most destructive form of birth control. SciPod. It's not just a podcast, it's a blessed event.
Space travel is a challenging business at the best of times. There are many risks involved in getting a planetary probe off the ground, and even more when it reaches its destination. But the one part of the voyage when you can usually count on things going smoothly is when a spacecraft is cruising through empty space. And that's exactly why NASA scientists were puzzled when one of their most famous space probes was found to be drifting ever so slightly off of its expected trajectory. This left scientists with a rather incredible choice. Either the spacecraft is changing its own course by some mechanism that no engineer planned, or the laws of physics need some significant rewriting. Faced with these possibilities, there's really only one thing NASA can do, and that's fly the mission all over again. But this time, the launch pad is a computer.
From the moment it was launched in 1972, Pioneer 10 was destined for the history books. It was the first spacecraft to fly through the asteroid belt and enter the outer solar system. It sent back the first close-up images of Jupiter. Then it was flung outward on a course that would take it beyond the solar system forever. The first human-made object bound for the stars. It was at this point that the amazing story of Pioneer 10 took an unexpected turn. During the 1980s, as it continued to radio data back to Earth, Pioneer began behaving strangely. The data itself was normal, just the usual life signs of an aging spacecraft. But the signal that carried it was not. Dr. Slava Turyshev explains.
Suddenly, we started to resolve an interesting background, and that background was presented to us as a Doppler frequency drift. Essentially, we sent a signal, radio signal, up to the spacecraft, and then we receive a signal back on the ground. And if we know everything well, so that the received signal should be perfectly known to us, we model the signal and we observe the signal. The difference should be zero, but in fact we were observing the signal that was drifting in time.
The drift in Pioneer 10's signal was exactly what you'd expect if a small force were pulling on the spacecraft, but it wasn't clear what that force might be. And then Pioneer 11, a sister ship that was also leaving the solar system, started to show the same effect.
Initially, we thought that most likely it was a gas leak. Gas leak, it's a propulsion leakage from the propulsion system from the two spacecraft. And realistically, we didn't pay much attention to this signal until maybe late 80s, when we anticipated that the signal will decay or go away. But no, the signal was very strong. And the further spacecraft moved away from the sun, the stronger the signal became.
At that point, Slava Turyshev wasn't yet working for NASA. He's a theoretical physicist of the kind that you don't usually need when you're travelling around the solar system. But as the 80s rolled into the 90s and the Pioneer anomaly refused to go away, flight engineers thought it might be a good idea to bring in someone who knew a thing or two about gravity.
I joined a jet propulsion laboratory in 1993, and essentially I came from a background in general relativity, where I was studying very small effects of general relativity on the motion of planets and satellites. And I thought that with my background, I should be able to come up with effect that was not accounted for. So it led to very significant analysis of every term in the model that we used to model the motion of the spacecraft. And essentially, at the end of this analysis, I concluded that general relativity is correctly counted, and so is the many other effects that are part of the standard modeling of the motion of the planetary probes.
In other words, Turishev couldn't find anything in the known laws of physics that would explain why the two pioneers were acting this way. There was still a good chance that something about the design of the spacecraft itself was causing it to change course. Perhaps the way it radiated heat into space, for example. But if that isn't the case, then Pioneer has discovered something completely new.
So what we are talking about is a very interesting, very intriguing effect, because it is large enough to be detected and it is small enough to go undetected for such a long time, because the sensitivity of our observations until recently was not good enough to detect signals like this. And so now, when our technology is improving, we are able to study and detect those small forces that might be indicating very interesting phenomena that are hidden in the outer solar system.
Incidentally, the other two spacecraft that are now leaving the solar system, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, aren't showing the Pioneer effect. That's probably because they're more sophisticated and can stabilize and correct their own motions in space. Both Pioneers are now effectively dead. The last signal from Pioneer 10 was picked up in January 2003, more than 30 years after launch. But now Slava Turishev and his colleagues are hoping to resurrect these two missions. In fact, they're planning the virtual equivalent of flying them all over again, in the hope of finally figuring out what caused the Pioneer anomaly.
We will be focusing on the conventional physics exploration, because every extraordinary claim requires extraordinary justification. So, in fact, we will be focusing on the every known physical mechanism that we are aware of in attempt to explain the Pioneer anomaly with conventional physics. But if at the end we will fail to gain support within the within the standard physics, then we probably will turn our heads to some unusual explanations.
Later this year, Turishev and his colleagues will literally rerun Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 in a computer simulation. They'll repeat every step of both missions, including trajectory corrections and planetary flybys. Along the way, they'll compare every moment of their simulated missions to the data that came back from the real Pioneers and see if they can recreate the anomaly, too. But just getting to this point has been an odyssey. Before boldly going where no computer simulation has gone before, Turishev first had to restore all the Pioneer data and assemble the real mission history to serve as a basis for comparison. It was a journey into the history of spaceflight.
First of all, this is a very long mission. It's 30 years of data. And back then, people were using punch cards to navigate the spacecraft. There was no computers as we know it. So we had to go back in time and look through mainframe computers, look for the outputs on punch cards and different ways of input and output. There were some times where I find myself in a dusty environment looking through boxes of with magnetic tapes, and those boxes were stored in the places being untouched for so many months and years, so that the boxes were covered with about maybe an inch thick, or maybe 2 centimeters thick dust.
In the end, after all the dusty rooms, old computers, and all the reprogramming to translate different forms of code into one universal language, Turishev had what no one had ever had before: a continuous record of what really happened to the two Pioneer spacecraft from launch onward. Now he has what he needs to fly Pioneer all over again. The simulation is expected to take over a year. By then, Turishev hopes to find out whether the Pioneer anomaly is caused by an unknown technical reason on the spacecraft, or whether it really is the sign of a new kind of force at work in the solar system. Whichever way it goes, the result will have an impact.
If it will be explained with just the standard physics, possibly such as gas leaks or maybe thermal radiation, it is very significant, because as we build new spacecraft, as we try to study smaller, very tiny effects in the solar system, we should be able to design spacecraft that will not be producing bad, unwanted forces. And the study of the Pioneer anomaly will help us to identify those forces and account for them in the design of future missions. And that would benefit fundamental physics research in space tremendously. But if this is new physics, the outcome is tremendous. So I should not be talking about new physics here, but realistically, if we will identify it, if we will identify the Pioneer anomaly as something that lies outside the conventional physics, it will be very, very important.
In this case, important is an understatement. If Pioneer has discovered a new phenomenon, it will change the course of modern physics. But Slava Turyshev isn't thinking about that just yet. He's just thinking about getting an answer to a problem that's occupied his imagination for the last 13 years.
It is an amazing feeling because it's a new chapter in the big book on the Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 missions. I don't know what is written on this page.
This time, when Pioneer 10 launches, no one will hear the rumble of a rocket exhaust. There won't be any television cameras or crowds gathered by the launch pad, but there will be an adventure, and a result that could be the biggest discovery yet from a spacecraft called Pioneer.
And you can find out more about Slava Turyshev and his efforts to rerun the Pioneer missions by exploring this week's issue of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Move over relativity, step aside quantum mechanics. At long last, modern physics has given us a theory that really matters. One that answers perhaps the most puzzling scientific question of all time. Which freezes first, hot or cold water? Jonathan Katz is a man who claims to have cracked this icy conundrum. He's a professor of physics at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri.
Dr. Katz, I remember debating this question in my undergraduate physics days. What freezes more quickly, hot or cold water? It's a classic question in kitchen physics. Can you start by telling us why this even is a question?
Well, it's a question because a Tanzanian high school student named Mpemba was freezing ice cream mix, and he discovered that when he put it in the freezer hot, it froze sooner than his fellow students' mix that was put in cold. And this, of course, is not what you'd expect.
In fact, I think it defies logic even to think that something hot would freeze sooner, because just from basic thermodynamics, you would think, well, if something's warmer, it has to pass through that colder temperature before it gets on its way to being frozen. So it seems, you know, how could it possibly be a shorter trip?
That's everybody's reaction. In fact, it was the reaction of Mpemba's teachers, and they said, no, this is obviously nonsense, do it until you get it right, which is not the way you're supposed to respond to an experimental observation. So Mpemba, no one really took him very seriously until a visiting lecturer from the university came by and talked to him and said, this is interesting, and eventually they wrote up a paper. And it appeared in a physics education journal in the late 60s. And this led to a flurry of papers, partly in physics education journals and partly in New Scientist, and it occasioned a fair bit of head scratching. Now, it turns out that, although Mpemba's name is now attached to it, he wasn't the first to notice this. In fact, there's a fairly clear reference in Aristotle and a couple of medieval references.
You're not telling me that Aristotle was debating whether he should put hot or cold water into his freezer, are you?
Well, Aristotle in his Meteorologica reports that it's well known that hot water will freeze before cold. And it's been folk wisdom in many other cultures, for example in Canada, that hot water pipes freeze before cold water pipes in the winter.
Yes, and speaking as a Canadian myself, I can actually confirm this.
Okay. So there hasn't been much serious scientific work on trying to understand why, but it was not something you could dismiss.
So then, Dr. Katz, we've got this outstanding problem. How did you come to be thinking about this? I imagine the people who pay your salary at WashU didn't exactly have this at the top of your to-do list.
No. One of my students in a class I give for non-science majors called How Things Work, I invite students to ask what I call Stump the Professor questions. Questions from everyday life, things they've read about, things they've heard about. And so the student's question, her name was Nadia Makaloon, and she should get some credit for this, The student's question reminded me of it, and I said, I don't know. I've heard the story. Let me think about it. I didn't really think very much about it immediately, but then I was proctoring the exam on the course, and that was 3 hours of mind-numbing boredom. So I started thinking about it. Now, it's clear that your simple picture that hot becomes cool and cool becomes cold and cold then freezes, that can't be the whole story.
Right.
Because if that were the case, the cold water has a head start and there's no way you could overtake it. So it's clear that to explain this, something must happen to the water when you heat it that changes it. So it must be more water must be described by more than one variable, not just by temperature. There must be something else. Well, what happens to water when you heat it is if stuff is dissolved in it, some of the things that are dissolved in it are removed. In particular, things whose solubility decreases with increasing temperature. Now, that's fairly unusual, but it's not unheard of. And in fact, the prime case of things whose solubility in liquids decreases with increasing temperature is gas. It's well known that you heat water, you remove gas. But it's also possible to show that the solubility of gases, common gases, in water isn't very high, and there wouldn't be enough to have a significant effect.
So, you know, oxygen in water or some of the other gases that might be dissolved in water, you're saying there probably doesn't make that much difference between hot or cold.
Because there's very little of them. Oxygen and nitrogen, which are obviously what the atmosphere is mostly made of, have only very slight solubility in water. Carbon dioxide, which turns out to be the key to the story, is more soluble, but there's very little carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so not much actually dissolves in water.
Okay.
But it turns out there's something closely related to carbon dioxide, and that's called hardness, or actually the different kinds of water hardness. This is called temporary hardness, and the chemical involved is calcium bicarbonate.
So this is a mineral dissolved in, say, tap water, right?
It's dissolved in ordinary tap water. If that tap water has been groundwater that's passed through a limestone formation. And it's called temporary hardness. And the reason it's called temporary hardness, there are other chemicals that make what's called permanent hardness. The reason this is called temporary hardness is because if you heat the water, calcium carbonate precipitates, and carbon dioxide is released to the atmosphere. And in fact, this is a well-known phenomenon. It's called, in boilers or hot water pipes, it's called boiler scale, the limestone deposit. And in tea kettles, it's called kettle fur. And if you look inside your tea kettle, unless you're in a very soft water area, you will find whitish deposits of what is lime. It's basically limestone rock.
So this mineral is kind of dropping out of the hot water. How does that play into the freezing process?
Okay. So it means that water that's been heated is no longer has the dissolved mineral. Water that has not been heated still has the dissolved mineral. Now you go and freeze them. Well, dissolved minerals, or dissolved anything, reduces the freezing point of water. So the water that's been heated is now has nothing dissolved in it, and so it can freeze at 0 degrees centigrade. The cold water still has the hardness, the dissolved mineral that came out of the tap. So it's got to chill to a lower temperature to freeze.
So what you're saying is that it's not actually a fair race, that the hot water is not heading for the same freezing point that the cold water is heading for.
That's right. It's heading for a higher freezing point, or to put it in another way, the freezing point of the cold water is depressed because the cold water still contains the hardness, the calcium bicarbonate. Now, if you try to do that quantitatively, estimate the effect quantitatively, it's actually insignificant. It's hundredths of a degree. And the reason is it just isn't that much calcium bicarbonate in ordinary hard water, until you think about it a little bit more carefully. There's another important property of ice. So when you form an ice crystal from water, hard water, water that has this dissolved mineral in it, or water that has dissolved carbon dioxide in it, that dissolved stuff is expelled from the crystal. And so there's a layer of the liquid right next to the crystal, which contains all of the dissolved mineral or gas that was in the crystal, was in the ice, as well as what was already in the liquid. So the concentration is much increased right next to where the freezing occurs, at the freezing front, as we call it. You can work out a simple theory for this, and the result is that the effect is perhaps 50 times or 100 times bigger than it would be if you didn't have this concentration right where the freezing occurs. And that factor of nearly 100 is absolutely essential. That's what turns an effect that's hundredths of a degree, and you'd never notice it in everyday life, into an effect that can be several degrees, and you really do notice in everyday life.
Now, Dr. Katz, it seems like an elegant and remarkably straightforward answer. I mean, you're talking about fairly simple principles of physics here. Why do you think no one has come up with this answer before?
Well, so there have really only been two serious quantitative studies of this phenomenon, despite its experience in folklore. And one was by a man named Auerbach, who did the study at Perth. And unfortunately, he was a very careful scientist. And I say unfortunately because of being a very careful scientist, he made sure that he knew what his water was. He carefully deionized and degassed his water before doing his experiments.
So there was no Mpemba effect then?
Right. He got some supercooling. He got some erratic and non-reproducible effects, which is supercooling effects, which is what you expect from very clean water. But he had no possibility of observing an Mpemba effect, if what I say is correct. And then there was a Polish group, actually, earlier, and they've got the only quantitative data on the Mpemba effect, and they very definitely saw it, but they never actually characterized their water as to hardness. You read their paper, and they never tell you.
Well, I guess that explains why it hasn't been thought of up till now. I guess the next obvious question is, do you have any plans to put your hypothesis to the test? This seems to be calling out for someone to get out the ice cube tray and start freezing.
It's certainly calling for someone to do that. It's going to take a little bit more than an ice cube tray. You've got to be fairly careful. It can't be done sort of amateur style. So I'm not going to do it for a couple of reasons. One, I don't have a laboratory. Second, I don't have any research support that could pay for this. Third, I'm prejudiced. I got a hypothesis. I shouldn't be testing it. You know, that's like having the prosecutor also be the jury in a criminal trial. Someone else who doesn't have a vested interest, hasn't put his name on the line, should do the experiment and see if I'm right or wrong.
Dr. Katz, I want to thank you for giving us this answer. I can hardly wait to call up my old classmates and tell them that I think I know why the hot water freezes faster. I wish you luck in getting this hypothesis proven.
Thank you.
Great talking to you.
Okay.
Dr. Jonathan Katz is a physicist. A theoretical physicist, mind you. And his solution to the Mpemba effect is covered in the current issue of New Scientist. And now it's time for this week's science news. How many clocks does a body need? According to new research, the answer may be two. It's now commonly understood that the body's daily rhythm of wakefulness and sleep is controlled by a biological clock. The master timekeeper that regulates this clock is in part of the brain known as the suprachiasmatic nucleus. But now it seems this picture may be too simple. Researchers at the Oregon National Primate Research Center have found a second biological clock in monkeys' adrenal glands, located above the kidneys. By looking at gene activity in these glands, the scientists found 322 genes that have 24-hour cycles, including six that influence the suprachiasmatic nucleus. This second body clock might control when the adrenal glands release hormones such as cortisol, which affects wakefulness. So next time you're feeling sleepy, it might be your adrenal glands saying it's time for a nap. Here's a paradox. Why does the stimulant, methylphenidate, better known as Ritalin, calm down children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD? A new investigation with rats may provide an answer. Researchers at Drexel University in Philadelphia gave Ritalin to rats and then watched how their brains responded to signals from their whiskers. In rats on Ritalin, the team found nearly twice the usual levels of noradrenaline, or norepinephrine, a neurotransmitter which probably serves to fine-tune the brain's response. The drug also reduced secondary responses to each whisker movement, indicating that the animals were paying no further attention to the tweaked whisker. In other words, the Ritalin appeared to sharpen the rat's senses while blocking their response to unwanted distractions. And finally, the only form of birth control with the blessing of the Catholic Church may cause more embryo death than other forms. The so-called rhythm method involves abstaining from sex during a woman's fertile period. Many couples practice the rhythm method because other forms of contraception are forbidden by the Catholic Church. But researchers at the London School of Economics estimate that more embryos die because of the rhythm method than other methods of contraception. Conceptions can still occur outside of a woman's fertile period, but these embryos are more likely to fail. The researchers estimate that the rhythm method probably causes more failed embryos than unprotected sex at random times during the menstrual cycle. If it proves to be true, couples using the rhythm method for religious reasons may want to think again.
We hope you're enjoying this week's episode of SciPod. We received lots of good and very useful feedback after last week's show, and we love hearing from you, so keep those emails coming. If you've got a comment or question about anything to do with our podcast, it's easy to reach us. Just send your message to podcast@newscientist.com. And thanks again for listening.
If you're listening to us on an iPod, you may already be aware of a growing problem in digital music. Basically, there's too much of it. The latest digital players have space for up to 10,000 tracks, and the availability of new music on the web is growing at a rate that's impossible to keep up with. So what's a music lover to do? The answer may lie in getting our computers to select our music for us. But how do we program a machine which can't even hear music, let alone understand it, to interpret the fickle nature of human taste? This week, New Scientist takes a closer look at this problem and at some of the solutions that are already on the market. One of the most advanced is a free software package called Music IP Mixer, and we decided to try it out. To help us get started, we spoke with Matthew Dunn, the president and CEO of Music IP.
Matthew, I'd like to start with your thoughts on the problem that your software is designed to solve. Why do you think it's so difficult to program a computer to choose our music?
It's hard for several reasons. There's a lot of music in the world, and we're only starting to uncover really how much there is. Our company has analyzed the musical attributes of 19.5 million tracks, and the number just keeps going up. So there's a lot of music out there. That's more than any one person is going to thumb through to select. The second issue is the really intuitive one. What is it that gives a piece of music its particular appeal?
And how does your software address that problem?
We address it by doing a consistent, very complex analysis of dozens and dozens of the factors present in the sound of a piece of music and capturing the results of that analysis in a way that lets us relate one song to another. Our intent is not to be dictatorial and say, you will like this song, but discovery-based. We think you'll like this song. You can always hit the skip button, but if we can narrow down to one or two or 10 out of 19 million, we think we're doing listeners a huge favor.
Now, this raises some interesting questions because, of course, music can be categorized verbally. I mean, this often happens in music stores. You know, there's the country and western bin, there's the R&B bin, and so on. And the reason we're talking about this, I think, is everyone understands that those verbal descriptions just kind of fall short. You know, there's so many different kinds of music that fall under the R&B category, even when you divide it more finely. In fact, no matter how finely you divide it verbally, words just don't capture what the music is saying. So what is it in the music that your software is looking at? What attributes, or how is it quantifying those so it can compare different tracks?
Well, philosophically, I'm in the same camp that you're in, for sure, that the verbal descriptors just don't cut it. In fact, they're worse. They're misleading. They're inaccurate, because your version of R&B and my interpretation of R&B aren't the same thing, even if it's the same label. As to what our software looks at, it's a much longer discussion that's going to fit on a podcast, but in brief, we focus on patterns in sound, and that's what music is made of. We focus on patterns of the types of instrumentation that we can detect. We focus on patterns that are repetitive things over time present in a piece of music. I mean, you can think, and I'm sure the listeners can think, of some easy examples, measuring the beats per minute, measuring the volume.
Right. So
those are not verbal constructs. They're measurable. There they are in the waveforms of music kinds of things.
Okay, well, why don't we try an example and put the software to the test and see what happens. We've got our closing theme song queued up. This is Surf and Smurf by the Damn Neighbors. So we'll play a snippet of that, and we'll see what happens with Music IP. So here's the theme music. Okay, so there's the song. Now, you've put that through your system, and hopefully it's retrieving things that I might be interested in listening to if I find this song interesting. So what has it brought back?
Right. Well, I took that and I put it in our desktop software, and frankly didn't get anything out of my collection that's quite like that. So I took it to the next stage and said, what's available out there in the world? I threw that at our current commercial global music search engine. And here's what it came back with. First track is a track called Falling Apart by a band called Dash Rip Rock. Here goes. Second track in that list was a track called Sexual Power Trip by a group called Blue October. I'm sorry for the way I treated you. I'm stuck in my ways to just run in the opposite way. Not exactly the same instrumentation. You can definitely hear some beat similarities there. And then we start to get some variety in the playlist. Beck, pretty well-known artist, with a track called Broken Train. The question to ask is not, is it identical? Because no two pieces of music are. And the question to ask is not, would a musicologist match these up? The question to ask is, would you keep listening to those? Do they musically resonate with you if you're really digging the theme song from this podcast?
Right. Now, Matthew, the first thing I'm going to mention is that what you're retrieving for us are all samples from commercial sites in the interest of science. And so in the interest of not being sued at the end of this segment, we'll provide the URLs for anyone who's interested in going online and purchasing these albums. But what strikes me is exactly what you said, which is that these songs do not sound that much like the sample I gave you, at least in their musical details, although they have something in common in the groove, I guess. So it seems like there's got to be some kind of learning process involved for the software to make what seem to be, rather creative or unexpected connections. How do you tackle that learning problem?
Well, we cracked the learning part quite a while back in setting a foundation that we continue to grow from. As I mentioned before, we're at a staggering, even to us, 19 million tracks that we've analyzed. And in the way our technology is designed, we're able to continue refining our ability to point to music based on having a bigger and bigger set. So it's constantly learning with a flood of information, a flood of input. That wasn't the important step in terms of refining this, though. The important step was, and it shouldn't be surprising, was getting our technology deployed and in the hands of people who actually listen to music and starting to get their feedback, their reactions, so that we could continue to tune and refine and add algorithms and add controls for them.
I guess this also raises some philosophical questions, which is, is aesthetic taste programmable, or what does this tell us about the way certain kinds of performances appeal to us?
That's a big one and a deep one, we're not going to get answers on it. We're going to get vectors on that as people start listening to music differently, which is what we think has to happen because of the increase in supply as music becomes a digital network medium. My personal take on it is we'll find that we've been stuck within the genre barrier for far too long, that what we thought were our tastes were really dictated by our paltry selection mechanisms, not by our actual musical appetites.
Well, thanks, Matthew. It sounds like you've given us a new way to appreciate our music and hopefully to access a lot more of it.
I hope that's what happens. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Matthew Dunn is president and CEO of Music IP. We reached him in Monrovia, California. As Ivan said, the music you heard in this piece is available for purchase at www.bymusichere.net. And that's about it for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the June the 4th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, The Century Club. How do you live to 100 and enjoy it? Easy. You start by reading our New Scientist special report on the emerging science of longevity.
Start spreading the news. Hurricane season is back, but it's not just New Orleans that needs to worry. We take a closer look at the threat to New York City and the ambitious plan to protect it.
And how to drive those calories away. Researchers power a fuel cell by feeding chocolate to bacteria.
This week's edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Patrick Berry, Claire Bowles, Marcus Chown, Stuart Clark, Ben Crystal, Rowan Hooper, Valerie Jameson, Kurt Kleiner, and Justin Mullins. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by The Damn Neighbors.
John McFarlane is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenik. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.